I'm joined today by Chu Jilton, who is the co-founder and connections extraordinaire for the Unreasonable Institute. Chu, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
I'd first love to ask you to explain to us what the Unreasonable Institute is. It's been getting some attention, and you launched it officially in 2008 as a nonprofit, but you're getting ready to host your first institute session this summer in 2010. So can you explain to us what your goals are with it?
Sure. Well, the Unreasonable Institute, in one word, is a mentor-intensive incubator for early-stage social ventures. So what we do is we find young entrepreneurs from around the world who hunger to take the world's greatest social and environmental problems, like poverty and climate change, and put them in a museum. So we bring them to Boulder, Colorado, after carefully selecting them, for 10 weeks, where we provide them rigorous entrepreneurial training, access to seed capital, legal advice, prototype consulting, and mentorship from 50 proven entrepreneurs and investors who guide them. The ultimate goal is to incubate these ventures so that they meet four criteria. One is that they're effective at addressing social and environmental problems. Two, they can do so in a way that's financially self-sustaining. They have some kind of internal revenue-generating mechanism for covering their cost of operations. So that, number three, they can scale their operations within 3 years of launching their venture outside of the country of their origin. These are global challenges that they're addressing. We want our entrepreneurs to meet them on a global level. And finally, four, we want to incubate ventures that reach the needs of at least 1 million people. That's the scope on which we hope our ventures can create impact. So that's kind of the Unreasonable Institute and our goals with the organization. The name comes from a quotation by George Bernard Shaw, the Irish playwright, who said, "The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man and woman, of course." And that's exactly what we're attempting to do with the Unreasonable Institute.
So the way that it's working is you opened it up for submissions, and that was last fall in 2009. You had over 200 entrepreneurs submit applications from 45 countries and 6 continents. You then narrowed it down to 34 finalists who used the Unreasonable Institute's platform to fundraise their costs for the Institute, which takes place this summer in Colorado. And it's a $500 cost to attend. They are not allowed to pay for. They must fundraise for. So talk to us. Well, before I even get into that mechanism, I just wanted to give that kind of that framework about how that the Unreasonable Institute function, but how did this idea come about? For me, it sounds a little bit like the Y Combinator, which is founded by Paul Graham, that incubates entrepreneurs with low-level amounts of seed capital, but intense incubation process. So where did the idea for the Unreasonable Institute come from?
Well, the idea came from a lot of different places, actually. Fundamentally, it comes from the fact that all of us as the co-founders of the organization in college were people who really wanted to find ways to address the world's greatest problems. And we started social ventures of our own, but most of them failed because we lacked credibility, experience, seed capital, networks, mentors, those kinds of things. We as young people wanted to have a place where we could learn the practical tools that we need to create solutions to these kinds of problems. And we surveyed the market, really, looking for a place where we could find these kinds of tools. And there are a lot of, incubators, there are a lot of organizations that provide services. But the most effective model that we came across was exactly the Y Combinator model. And we came across that model in an organization called TechStars, which is Boulder-based incubator for technology startups, very similar to Y Combinator, that brings, 10 entrepreneurial teams to Boulder for 12 weeks and provides them mentorship and seed capital. That model has been so effective for TechStars, partly because of the selection process, but also because of the mentorship process, that 70% of the ventures they incubate are profitable in the first year. and 90% are profitable in the second year. So realizing how profoundly impactful this model could be, we want to see the exact same thing with social ventures. So this was one of the original inspirations for the 10-week mentor intensive at the Unreasonable Institute. And, you know, we really wanted to fuse this idea with social entrepreneurship because of, you know, I had visited India, for example, and done some research about effective approaches for dealing with poverty and had found that most traditional charity-based approaches were really failing to profoundly impact the problem because they weren't sustainable and they weren't scalable. It was really only the organizations that were treating the poor as customers and entrepreneurs instead of recipients of charity that were creating a profound and scalable impact. So those are
the kinds of organizations. Can you share with us some of the ones that impacted you in terms of their non-charitable approaches?
Sure. I mean, mostly they were. Locally based organizations like one called Avai Welfare Society, which operates in Tamil Nadu in India. Probably a more well-known one that I came across was called International Development Enterprises, started by Paul Polak, which is an organization that's lifted 19 million people out of poverty by providing farmers access to affordable irrigation pumps that can provide them water to irrigate their crops during the dry seasons and thus enable them to make more income from farming. So, those are some of the organizations that profoundly impacted us and, you know, helped us understand the potential of social entrepreneurship. So that's kind of, you know, where some of these ideas have come from.
So it was with this research and this look at poverty and institutions in India, coupled with market research around more entrepreneurial or technology-focused incubation organizations from which the Unreasonable Institute was born. And I guess the heavy dose of, as you mentioned, you and your own frustrations while trying to get your social enterprises off the ground.
Exactly. And also frustration as young students. You know, when I was in college, I was an international affairs major, and I was frustrated by the fact that my education was so theoretical. It didn't in any way prepare me to address the world's greatest problems, like I hoped that it would. And this is something that really has come from the president of the Unreasonable Institute, Daniel Epstein. It's been a big push for him to always create a place where young people can create solutions to global problems and learn how to do that. And that's exactly what the Unreasonable Institute is about.
So I touched quickly on the idea that, or the fact that entrepreneurs, the finalists, cannot pay their way to the Unreasonable Institute. So talk to us about how these 25 final entrepreneurs are selected from the current 34 who are now vying selection statements.
Sure. So we realize in the selection of entrepreneurs that there are a couple of challenges that we face. One is, we want to walk our own model in the sense that we also want to be financially self-sustaining within a year so that we can really serve the demand of young entrepreneurs who want to create social and environmental impact and so that we can scale our efforts. So that was one issue that we wanted to face. At the same time, we realized, though, that a lot of the entrepreneurs we want to bring to the Institute, including, for example, former child soldiers from Liberia or Ugandan refugees, you know, would not be able to afford $6,500, which is the cost of attending the Institute. And then the third piece of it is all the research that we've done in terms of selection really says that the most powerful way to select someone for a job as an entrepreneur, et cetera, is to ask them to do the thing you'd like them to do. So if you're hiring someone for a position in sales, you should ask them to sell you something. Similarly, if we want to select the best entrepreneurs, we should have them demonstrate their entrepreneurial mettle, ask them to do something entrepreneurial. So the solution we came up with was something we call the Unreasonable Finalist Marketplace, which is an online platform where entrepreneurs can showcase their ventures to the world. The world then votes with their dollars on the ideas that they think are most viable for creating impact. So the way that it works is all of our finalists in the selection process are charged with raising $6,500 to attend the institute. They're not allowed to pay any of that money, but they have to go out and get people to believe in their idea enough to support them with their dollars. The first 25 to raise that $6,500 are the ones who show up, who are invited to attend the institute. So what this does is it enables us to cover our cost of operations. It makes the institute affordable for any person, whether they're from, you know, the suburbs of Boston, or whether they're from, you know, Kampala, Uganda, that they can come to the institute. And then finally, it means that the entrepreneurs who do show up at the institute have 200, 300 people backing them, supporting the work that they're doing and saying, yes, this person needs to be at the institute. We need their idea in the world. We need it to create impact. That's truly an inspiring inspiring thing. So that's the platform that we've devised to select our entrepreneurs.
I have to say, I think that that's very smart in the way that it kind of equalizes the playing field and then uses the market mechanics to promote the best ideas. But how are you working to involve the public now? How do you the selection process from being Americans or Europeans who have more access to internet and friends and family who can donate more money to push them forward into the placement position? How are you getting the rest of the public involved so that I could have the opportunity to see what someone in, as you mentioned, Liberia is doing and contribute to them, as opposed to just getting an email from a friend who said, hey, can you help me out here?
Totally. Yeah, that's an excellent question. So, we did realize very quickly in this kind of platform that there's a problem, which we call the rich uncle problem.
That is a terrific term for it.
Yeah, exactly. In which, you know, one of our finalists, for example, could contact a friend or a, you know, wealthy benefactor, somebody who could give them the full amount or a lot of money very quickly so that they could raise the funds to attend the institute. And it wouldn't be fair because probably, you know, the Ugandan refugees don't have that same luxury. It's not a good test of their entrepreneurial ability from our view. So what we did is institute weekly maximums. So in the first week that the marketplace is open, the maximum contribution that any sponsor can make to any finalist is $10. In the second week, that maximum contribution is $50. In the third week, it's $100, and it slowly increases until the end of the marketplace. So what this means is the marketplace is skewed in favor of those people who can go out and quickly, rapidly raise the funds that they need to attend the institute from a lot of different sponsors. So it sort of further democratizes the process. That doesn't mean that it's a perfect system because, indeed, no matter what, maybe entrepreneurs from the United States or from Europe are more likely to have wider networks anyway. However, what we found from a lot of the research about online marketplaces has been that often entrepreneurs, you know, like the former child soldiers in Liberia that are finalists in the selection process, have better stories. And a lot of, you know, Americans are drawn to funding these entrepreneurs. A lot of our partners have expressed interest once the maximum contributions rise and are significant enough to make significant enough contributions to help support these ventures to come to the Unreasonable Institute. This whole marketplace is something, it's the first time that we're doing it. It's something that we hope to learn a lot from, iterate appropriately so that in the following years we can improve its equitability and make sure that it's really a smooth process that really does enable us to test entrepreneurial ability and at the same time give entrepreneurs from all parts of the world a fair shot at attending the Unreasonable Institute.
And are you able to see if there's engagement on the site from people who are unrelated to these entrepreneurs? So, and the second one asks, what type of work have you been doing to get the public, strangers, involved? Because it really is a fascinating process, and I like that in the way that Kiva allows you online connection, a personal connection in a sense of where your money is going and what this entrepreneur hopes to accomplish, you allow the user to have a very similar experience. So I think it's a rewarding user experience, getting people to know about it.
Right, absolutely. Yes, we are able to tell on the marketplace whether or not the people who are supporting the ventures are strangers to the finalists or they know them. In the process of sponsoring any finalist, we ask sponsors, do you know this entrepreneur personally? So the data from, the first five entrepreneurs that have raised the $6,500 they need to attend the Institute is that 85% of their backers are people who know them personally, which is very interesting data. And that's a little bit different from other online marketplaces in which the majority of backers happen to be 2 degrees of separation out from the entrepreneur in question. And this is on platforms like Kickstarter or Global Giving. Most of the time the sponsors don't know who that entrepreneur is. And yes, we might equate that to the Unreasonable Institute being a startup organization and not having enough of a presence publicly as of yet. But, we have been doing a ton of market outreach, our media outreach, spreading the word amongst all our partner networks. So far, the marketplace has been featured in blogs from the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Inc. Magazine, all over Twitter, Facebook. We've been using all kinds of media channels to disseminate information about the marketplace. And amongst our partners are personal networks of, several thousand people each. So we've been trying as much as possible to spread the word about the marketplace and improve the number of participants who are strangers to these finalists.
So there's about 50 days or so until the marketplace closes?
Originally, yes, the marketplace is open for 50 days. I think at the current moment we have about 22 days left.
And how many, is it more than five entrepreneurs who thus far will be attending the Institute?
It will be up to 25 entrepreneurs in total who will attend the Institute. So far, five finalists have raised the full amount that they need to attend.
So after the 10 weeks this summer, which is the tactical and in the training with investors and entrepreneurs and mentors and experts, there's a pitch fest, which is a conference or maybe an unconference. And the idea for that is for the entrepreneurs to show off their work, but it's also gem with capital. Is that right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, they pitch their ideas to a room of maybe 200, 300 investors, enlightened philanthropists, and funders. With the hopes of obtaining the capital they need to launch.
So one of the things that I hear when I talk with other entrepreneurs who are working on socially driven businesses is that they have a really hard time accessing capital because investors basically see enterprise as a discount on the ROI. They don't see it as a full return. So what type of social investors and you mentioned philanthropy. Who are you bringing together as a potential funding source?
Okay.
Do you understand what I'm driving at with that question?
I do. Like, what kinds of investors are we looking at? What kinds of people, really, are we trying to bring to this
right.
pitch back?
It's a small niche still. It's not, you mentioned philanthropists, but you're looking for actual investors in social enterprises, so it's not only philanthropists, but that excludes a lot of the investor demographic not interested in social enterprises. So who is this magical crop of people that you're going to be giving your entrepreneurs access to?
That's a great question. Well, honestly, in terms of all the people that we're bringing to the pitch fest, we don't yet know. We are still structuring that conference or that pitch fest at the end of the Institute, and we'll be sending out invitations to a lot of different people. But fundamentally, for example, a couple organizations, for instance, that are really interested in attending are Grey Ghost Ventures, for example, which is a $400 million social investment fund, the founder of which, Bob Petillo, is one of our mentors, and is also the person who started First Light Ventures, which is an organization that's provided us $150,000 pool of capital, which will be allocated by the entrepreneurs at the Institute, amongst the entrepreneurs at the Institute, for example. So that's one way through which the entrepreneurs will be obtaining capital. But more importantly, it's a way in which they will sit on both sides of the table of investment and prepare themselves to answer the serious questions that investors will ask them down the road, to learn by doing, essentially, about the process of investment in general. So that's one group, for instance, who will be coming to the Institute, and they make, you know, impact investments. They've invested in microfinance ventures for a very long time, for instance. And so they're investing in for-profits, for example. But in terms of maybe non-profits, which we also incubate, we'd love to bring organizations to the table like the Skoll Foundation or Halloran Philanthropies. And Halloran Philanthropies, for example, has expressed a ton of interest in attending the Pitch Fest. So these are some of the organizations that I think will be represented at the Investors Conference or Pitch Fest at the end of the 10 weeks. But again, the truth is, you know, we're really yet to concretize the details of who will be there. So maybe ask me again in a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
And you know, that's interesting, and I'm curious about the question for the reason I asked. So what happens to your 25 entrepreneurs after the summer, after the conference, and after the Institute and after the Pitch Fest? Is there a continued structure or an alumni network, or what's the process then? Because you're now getting a whole new batch of applicants in and people to vote in the marketplace. It's a long cycle.
Right, absolutely. I think there are a couple of things that happen after the marketplace, after the 10 weeks of the Institute. One is that, you know, we really like to serve as agents for entrepreneurs, as in we'll continue to connect them with incredible opportunities, mentors, investors, partners that can really benefit their organization. And we hope to continue to support them with a global network of our partners and our sponsors and those sorts of contacts that we have around the world and that will continue to develop around the world. An example of that is, you know, our lawyer, Bruce Campbell, is really trying to work hard to develop an international network of lawyers for social enterprise. So he's interested, once we select our fellows, in finding legal consultants for our entrepreneurs in countries in which they're operating. So that's one of the ways, for example, we'll continue to support entrepreneurs through this global network. Additionally, obviously, we want to be relentlessly focused on impact. We want to understand that the Unreasonable Institute has actually made a difference in the trajectory of these ventures. And so we would like to compare the entrepreneurs incubated at the Institute to our finalists who were accepted basically at the finalist stage but ultimately didn't raise the $6,500. Sort of understand the difference between those who went through the process and those who we deemed really incredible entrepreneurs who did not go through the 10-week incubation program. So we're working hopefully with a professor at Emory and his team of PhD researchers on impact assessment, and which will hopefully continue and follow up over the course of years after the Institute, because we do have these criteria like for financial sustainability within a year, for scalability within 3 years, and eventually for reaching 1 million people. And, of course, for effectiveness. You know, if your goal is to move people out of poverty, how do you measure that, and how well have you done it? So that's another way that we hope to remain involved with these ventures after the Institute. And then finally, I think that many of the entrepreneurs that we incubate at the Institute are likely to make fantastic mentors for future batches of entrepreneurs we bring through the Unreasonable Institute. You know, especially if they're 2 years, 3 years out, they very much understand the struggles that entrepreneurs at this early stage are going through in terms of raising capital and awareness and securing members for their board and developing a brand and marketing, you know, to their intended customers, those kinds of things. So those are some of the three principal ways, I think, that we'll maintain relationships with the entrepreneurs after the 10 weeks.
So, and just so I understood that, you're going to be looking at the entrepreneurs who were selected as to participate in comparing their endeavors with the entrepreneurs who have gone through the Institute.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, the
okay.
finalists who don't raise, you know, if you're accepted as a finalist, as the Unreasonable Institute selection team, we've basically decided you are someone we would love to have at the Institute. Now it's simply a matter of you raising the funds and proving your entrepreneurial mettle. So from our point of view, all of our finalists, you know, could be Unreasonable Fellows. And the difference, of course, is the $6,500. The difference then is, you know, that our fellows go through the 10 weeks and the finalists don't. So there's some difference then in their trajectory. And that's what we're really interested in knowing.
One of the things that I've been very impressed that the Unreasonable Institute has done and your team, which is your founding team, is maybe four members. Is that right? Or have you maybe expanded?
Right. It's four people. Right.
Four people. This panel of mentors and advisors, and you're going to be bringing more people in to actually teach the courses during the Institute. So how do four young guys do this? How do you make sense? What do you offer these experts and these vetted entrepreneurs in return for their help? What's the value proposition that you bring to them?
That's a great question. I think it's two or three things. First of all, there's a quotation from Frederick Buchner that basically says, you know, your calling in life is where what makes you come alive intersects with the world's greatest hunger. For us, there's never been anything in our lives that has made us come alive more than the idea of finding young entrepreneurs and enabling them to create this kind of social impact. And that, to be very frank, I think is something that just, you know, we can't help but contain. I think mentors, investors, entrepreneurs, et cetera, are just really excited about this passion, especially in young people. And they really want to do everything that they can to support it. Because we're also looking for people who have that same kind of hunger and same kind of passion. So the opportunity to work with 25 of the world's most brilliant entrepreneurs who may eventually create the kind of progress that will be remembered by generations as having defined progress in our time, you know, is incredibly attractive to some of these entrepreneurs and investors who have agreed to serve as mentors. First and foremost.
Let me ask you, does this passion and this hunger, does it make you less self-conscious, less shy or timid about going to people who've got significant names and saying, hey, you know, we've got this going and we'd love your help? Does it displace some of that timidity?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. To some degree, you kind of lose yourself in this, and it's not about you as an individual. It's about what you're doing. So when you sit down and you talk to somebody, you know, it's not that you are there, but it's that you're representing this idea, this movement, this, you know, something that can really transform the world. I think that's electric, and that's something that people love to be a part of. I mean, it very much is about people. It very much is about interactions and genuine relationships. But I think when you have, you know, an idea or a passion like this, you talk to someone, you don't see, you know, their name, or you don't see the organization that they work for, the fact that they have like a $400 million salary. You know, you see a human being who deeply, deeply craves to take a problem like poverty and put it in a museum. And that's, I think, the thing that that binds, you know, these entrepreneurs and these mentors and to what they're doing and makes the Unreasonable Institute an attractive place to be.
So did you have an initial team of advisors or mentors that the four of you worked with? And, you know, excuse my prejudice here, but I feel, and it's also a compliment, but I think that a lot of the approaches you're taking are well researched, but they're more than just research. They're innovative and they're creative. And not to say that the four young people can't do this, but I always wonder, where do you go for help? And was it all from you guys? Have some people who guided you through the initial process?
Yeah, very much. I mean, when we start out, honestly, we really have the luxury of knowing nothing. I mean, we know what doesn't work to a large degree. We've tried to start social ventures and they have failed. But, you know, if we want to create something like this, there's so much that we don't know, which I think served as an advantage because, yes, it very much compelled us to go to a lot of people who do know what they're talking about and to relentlessly question them. And so, yeah, we talked to, you know, the Techstars founders, for example, like David Cohen, and got a sense of, and my partner Dan, you know, has really good relationships with David and some of the other people who were very involved in Techstars, and got a sense from them about, you know, okay, so what is the number one red flag in an entrepreneur? What is the thing that you as an investor or as an incubator for social ventures sees and says, I do not want to work with this entrepreneur? We learned quickly that it's ego. So our selection process should be tailored to entrepreneurs who are truly humble, who have an ability to learn from anyone, who have an ability to adapt to the needs of their customers, to changing market dynamics, those kinds of things. So, yes, we very much learned from people like Techstars and how they do what they do. And we very much looked around for ideas that work. You know, the marketplace is based on Kickstarter, which is an online platform that enables musicians and artists to raise the funds that they need to, you know, launch a CD or, you know, make a film or something like that. And, you know, that idea sort of demonstrated to us that this crowdsourcing model could work to fund enterprising young people as well. So very much the Unreasonable Institute has sort of taken pieces of other models that have worked, and we've really been driven by the question of what works and how can we apply it to enabling young entrepreneurs to create social and environmental impact. So, yes, very much we had a lot of people who guided us through this process.
And was there a specific proposition that you offered them? Was it, if you work with us, you have the opportunity to share your knowledge and to impact, you know, millions of people through these entrepreneurs? Or was it that you have opportunity to offer someone else the help you wish that you had received when you were starting out? Did you kind of, I don't like to say, you know, did you have different selling points like that?
You know, I think most of the time we began by listening really to any of these advisors. You know, just hearing about the incredible work that they're doing, asking them questions about it, and learning as much as we possibly could. And then when they asked us, you know, what are you working on? What are you trying to do here? We would share our vision with them and tell them what they were doing, and they were so excited by that. That often they would ask how they could be involved or how they could help. And, you know, we have a lot of roles, obviously, that they can play as mentors, for instance. And so that was something that we were, you know, very excited to have come up. But, I mean, I think that was really the way that most of the time it happened. And alternatively, you know, yeah, we would, in some cases, just say, like, look, you know, we'd really like to give you this opportunity. We strongly believe we can't afford to send the next generation of young people into the world unprepared to tackle global problems like poverty, like malnutrition and disease, and the oppression of women. And you, you know, are one of those pioneering thinkers, I think, who could really guide, you know, young entrepreneurs in addressing those problems. You serve a vital role, and you have this opportunity in front of you. And I think that is something that's also, yeah, deeply attractive to all of our mentors. So, definitely something that we told our mentors as well.
So your role is to develop relationships with the mentors and the funders and applicants, What's the biggest challenge with what you do for the Reasonable Institute?
The biggest challenge, well, in terms of my role, probably the biggest challenge is, this is a really hard question. I think one of the biggest challenges is time. You know, there's just so many amazing people to learn from and to work with, and you know, it's just hard to have the time that I would like, I think, to connect and spend with all of them. But fortunately, you know, this isn't a one-man operation, and I think all of the co-founders of the Unreasonable Institute also really have this job to some degree, which is, you know, developing relationships you know, really getting people excited and really seeing how we can help people. And that's something that my partner Daniel Epstein does incredibly well also. He's the president of the Unreasonable Institute. And a lot of the relationships that we have been deeply cultivated by him as well. But, you know, I mean, one thing that I think we've really learned in the process of connecting with people is that no matter who you're sitting across the table from, it's really important to treat them like they're the Messiah in the room. Like there's nobody more important than them at that time. And, you know, when you really do that, when you really dive into someone like that and can learn from them that much, you just uncover so much, and I think it's really challenging to, I guess, contain curiosity at times when you have to move quickly, when you have other things to do. But you know, fundamentally, I think everything that we're doing is about people, and that's the largest investment that we would like to make. So more than anything, you know, if we have a conversation with someone, it turns into a four-hour conversation, and that's just a conversation that lights us on fire. And you know, we're able to connect with someone who we deeply believe we can be of service to, or vice versa. I think that's just giving ourselves that space has been a challenge, but something that we continue to prioritize above all else. So,
I just had a question about that. That was interesting. And it speaks a little bit to one of the red flags of lousy entrepreneurs, which is ego and treating whomever you're with like the Messiah. Certainly, you have to possess less of an ego. So, you know, as you're saying that you live the model that you are putting forth, that speaks to that. Although I did have another question on that, which I can't remember. So, and I know that you have to go, but you... That means the idea of from George Bernard Shaw, The Power of Unreasonable People, the book by Elkington and Hardigan, and the Unreasonable Institute, that talks about social entrepreneurs and the different types of rationale that they have and the passion that drives them, and the idea of being relentless. How do you and your co-founders exercise this? What are some examples, or one or two examples you've had of being relentless, where maybe it didn't happen the first time, but because you were driven and because we're determined to persevere, something came through?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, some great examples are the marketplace. The marketplace, when we originally launched it, was riddled with technological problems. And that was very frustrating. For our finalists and for the sponsors who were trying to support them. You know, the marketplace at that time was dropping pledges. It was, you know, and it was embarrassing for our entrepreneurs who went out to their networks, emailed hundreds, thousands of people and said, look, the marketplace opens on this date, come and support me on that at that time. And when they did, they found, you know, a lot of pledges weren't working, et cetera. So, you know, I received, you know, hundreds of very angry and frustrated emails, understandably, and it was a tough time for all of us. I think all of us were working around the clock, maybe like 20 hours a day, almost for 2 weeks to get this marketplace back up and running. We eventually had to take it down. while we fixed all the bugs. And what we did is, you know, we made a very public and, I guess, transparent explanation of what happened. And we sent emails to all the sponsors and all the finalists and said, you know, these are problems that we face. This is totally our failure. You know, we made some mistakes in the programming and the coding, and we probably launched it before we should have, and that was, you know, to fulfill our promise of launching it on a certain date, and we really apologize for that. But, you know, we're doing everything that we possibly can to fix it. These are the steps that we're taking. And so I think for us, you know, that was a really difficult time, and it was, you know, no more than a month ago, but we learned that, I think, if you can be very honest about your failures, you can really grow from them and learn a lot from them, and people respect you more for that. And I think it's the same thing with human connection. I mean, deeply we connect with people when they can be honest with us about their weaknesses and their vulnerabilities. So I think the encouragement that we got when we were honest about our failure publicly from people was really something that enabled us to be relentless. You know, some of the finalists sent us poems, Rudyard Kipling's If, for example, which is a poem that one of our finalists reads when he's feeling like he's backed up against the wall, like he can't go any further. You know, a lot of our sponsors said, you know, like, this really is something that we appreciate. Like, thank you so much. You guys are doing some amazing things, and we'd really we really want to support you in that process. So let us know if there's anything we can do to help. So, I mean, I think sometimes just being honest is one of the best possible ways to be relentless, because it really does enable others to support you.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree, and I've heard that from other people. From telling people, you know, to sharing your idea, to asking for help, to acknowledging and apologizing for your failures, it really does allow people to grow closer to you, and it allows you to get more opportunities of help from people that you were closed off for. So with that in mind, the last question I have for you is, what can listeners do to help the Unreasonable Institute, to help these entrepreneurs? What do you need most from people out there now?
Right now, the most wonderful thing that anyone could do to support the Unreasonable Institute is to check out the Finance Marketplace. To browse through some of the entrepreneurs on there who are truly, you know, some of the most relentless and inspiring people that I've ever met or I've ever talked to, to support them. You know, support them with a small contribution of a couple dollars or hundreds of dollars, you know, whatever seems justified. And then to let 5 people know that this opportunity exists, and these are entrepreneurs who are poised to define progress in our time. I think that's the most profoundly impactful thing that any person could do to support the Unreasonable Institute and its entrepreneurs right now.
Okay, I've got one more question for you. It's more of a personal question. Would you have a favorite book or a couple of favorite books on the subject of social enterprise or, you know, poverty alleviation, which you've talked about?
Yes, one of my favorite books from which I have learned so much is called Out of Poverty by Paul Polak, who's the founder of International Development Enterprises and has a lot of practical tips for addressing social and environmental challenges and what the steps are to addressing those challenges in a very simple and effective way. Obviously, The Power of Unreasonable People is a book that you know, we've drawn a lot of inspiration from, which I definitely recommend checking out. How to Change the World by David Bornstein, specifically the chapter on the 6 characteristics of highly successful social entrepreneurs. Try to remember those all the time. You know, they include things like a willingness to not share credit, you know, not caring about recognition, and a willingness and an ability to self-correct, you know, as being one of the most important characteristics in entrepreneurs. So those are definitely 3 books that I would certainly check out. And one book that I'm reading now, which is not specifically focused on social entrepreneurship, but I think is really incredible, is called Switch, How to Create Change When Change is Hard by Chip and Dan Heath, who also wrote the book Made to Stick.
I've heard Made to Stick, and that's a great book.
Yeah, definitely a great book. So.
And all right, well, awesome. This is terrific. Juju, thank you. I wish you the best of luck. I really thank you for taking the time. I know you've been traveling and working hard to fight the technical issues and to keep getting the word out and to build the network of support mentors for these entrepreneurs. And I've been on the marketplace, and like I mentioned earlier, it really is a very rewarding experience for the users. I mean, in the same way that Kiva allows users to connect to what entrepreneurs are doing and how it's making an impact in people's lives, and so does the Unreasonable Institute. So thank you. Thank you for building this and putting it out there.
Well, I mean, it's truly like the only thing that we could, I think we could do with our lives. I mean, supporting these entrepreneurs. But I definitely want to thank you, Olivia, for this incredible opportunity to share a little bit about what we're doing. And I hope it was, good for, you know, people listening out there. So yeah, thanks so much for this chance.
For more interviews about Cause Capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.